following podcast is hashtag Boone approved. It's time for another edition of the Brett Boone Podcast.
Remember when me and you almost went to blows? Lou sent me down three times too, so I know what you're talking about.
With your host, MLB All-Star, Brett Boone.
Bottom line is, you will become a successful major league hitter by hitting pitchers' mistakes.
As he sits down with his sports and entertainment friends from around the world.
You are not going to be a successful major league hitter if you hit pitchers' pitches.
This isn't just any former jocks podcast.
To change the outcome, you got to change the income. You got to change what goes in. Then that changes what goes out.
Often duplicated, but never replicated. Just like his bat flip.
Okay, now the party starts. The responsibility starts now.
Now in its fourth year, this is the one and only Brett Boone Podcast.
Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. I am Brett Boone. Today, welcome back, a friend of the podcast. Today's guest is one of the most respected voices in baseball journalism, Fox Sports field reporter and senior baseball writer for The Athletic. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Ken Rosenthal. Kenny, thanks for coming back.
Brett, pleasure. How you doing, man?
Good, good. Let's get right into Hall of Fame. The list came out about a week ago. Question for you. Why are baseball writers the gatekeepers for the Hall of Fame?
That's kind of a loaded question, but I'll answer it.
I knew you would.
We do take it as a very serious responsibility. And I know there are times where people feel we do act as gatekeepers, particularly with the players who were accused of using performance-enhancing drugs or admitted to using performance-enhancing drugs. And it's been a problem voting for these guys or not, a real dilemma for a lot of voters. And my feeling is each voter has to vote his or her conscience or just their feeling subjectively about what is right and wrong. And I will tell you what I did. For several years, I did not vote for any of those players. And then when some started getting into the Hall of Fame, even though we did not know for sure that they had used, I was like, come on. So I voted for Bonds. I voted for Clemens. I don't vote for A-Rod because he obviously was suspended after the rules were in place and they were very clear. The same with Manny Ramirez. And you can argue, well, why are you being a gatekeeper for those guys? Those guys were great, great players, no question. That's just how I feel about it. So it's a legitimate debate. It's a legitimate thing for fans to question how we vote. But again, every voter, it seems to me, takes this rather seriously and just votes the way he or she thinks that they should.
In recent years, you're seeing, especially with online, the online presence and all the different media outlets you can get. I mean, I can see any. I want to see what Kenny's saying today. I can go out and go to your Twitter. So it's a different world than it was 15, 20 years ago.
It is.
Do you think it's better to be completely transparent if you're a voter or anonymous?
I do believe it's better to be completely transparent. And I am completely transparent with my ballot. It's interesting, Brett, with the awards votes, MVP, Cy Young, rookie, the BBWAA publishes those ballots. With the Hall of Fame, it is a personal choice. And we actually asked the Hall of Fame as an organization a few years ago if they would be willing to publish all of them. And they said, no, it's every voter's choice. So transparency can come with problems because online gets ugly. And people have their opinions, and they're not afraid to express their opinions. They're not afraid to express them in a way that they would never say to your face. Right. But at the same time, in my opinion, I'm a voter. It's a public thing, and I should be accountable to what I am voting for. Just as I ask players to be accountable when they talk to me after games about maybe something that they did and didn't work out so well. It's kind of the same thought to me. We have a public responsibility to be accountable the way we ask our subjects to be.
Does Ken Rose, do you have a process? For instance, you voted for somebody last year. This year you didn't vote for him, or vice versa, or it's the 10th year on the ballot. Or he's close to being in a limit. I don't know. Is there any criteria that you go into year to year leading up to this?
There is. And my first criteria is tenure dominance. That's what I look for. Yeah. Now, not every Hall of Famer fits that. Sandy Koufax was the classic short peak guy. But that's kind of a starting point for me. And then I look at comparables and guys who are in the Hall of Fame versus the guys who are eligible, and I try to narrow it down that way. Now, there are times where I will change a vote or adjust a vote. Classic case was Burt Blyleven, and he was a really interesting case because early on, he did not get much support. But as the sabermetric movement grew, those of us who were not necessarily inclined that way initially gained a greater appreciation from those people about what Blyleven was and who he was as a pitcher. And ultimately, I decided, okay, he crosses the line for me. What gets difficult, Brett, for me is when you have, I'll give you an example this year, a guy like CC Sabathia, who my instinct tells me, and the numbers tell me, is a Hall of Famer. 250 wins, wins still counted in his era, and 3,000 strikeouts. Andy Pettit is quite comparable to CC Sabathia. Almost, I won't say almost identical, but comparable. I don't know that Andy Pettit is a Hall of Famer. And this is the difficult part of voting, in my opinion, because once you vote for certain players, you feel obligated to vote for certain others, and it shouldn't necessarily be that way.
Yeah, you're right. Because, Kenny, as a player, I had a completely different take. Now, I took – we had a – you know, at the end of the year, you have a player's ballot. Who was the best player at each position? And I took that very serious, and I think the majority of my teammates did. It was very easy for me to separate personalities from what you did on the field. For instance, if I couldn't stand you, and there were a few players I couldn't, it didn't matter to me when I had that ballot in my hand because I respected it too much to think this game's too hard and this man, whether I like him or not, deserved what he did on the field. I had no problem voting for people that I really didn't care much for. That was an easy process for me. But as you say, the Blyleven situation, the current one with Sabathia and Andy Pettit. These are little quandaries. I had that with, you know, Freddie McGriff finally got in. But if you look back to a Carlos Delgado, didn't even get to the second ballot. And you look at his numbers, and they're eerily comparable to Freddie McGriff. I think they're both great players. But I understand what you're saying. For me, and I think we've talked about this before, I played with or against Jeff Kent for years and years. This man leads the history of the game in home runs as a second baseman. He's up there with 1,500 plus RBIs, which is very rare for a second baseman and how we were judged in my generation. Yet he doesn't get the love. You know, I don't know. I just, there's so many things that you're talking with. There's so many variables. And that's why when people are critical, especially on the player side, on my side about the Hall of Fame and how it's voted for, it's tougher than it sounds on paper. It's very much, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to talk to a player, you know, a teammate or somebody I played against for years that have a strong opinion. My question to them now, being on this side of the microphone and being a part of the media, is, okay, what would you do? How would you do it? I think it's very fair what you said about Alex and Manny. It's like, okay, the rules were in place and they blatantly broke the rules. Manny got caught twice, not once, but twice. You look at a Bonds, he never got caught. He was alleged, and I hate to say caught. I don't mean to say that. He never turned up.
Never tested positive.
Never tested positive. And it was really tough for me. I went through about 10 years where I'm sitting there going, well, people are just guessing who took him. You know, can we just play God now? And, oh, he hit home runs, so we must have taken him. He didn't hit home runs, which has nothing to do with anything. So as much as I still I'm a critic of the process, but at the same time, I respect the process because it's not an easy thing.
Well, I'm glad you make that point because that is the truth. It is not easy. And you made some good points about different players and the examples that persist to these days. To this day, Delgado is one. He's a guy that deserved a longer look, and he was a victim of the crowded ballot at the time. There was a period of time, I don't know, 5-7 years, where there were just too many candidates, and the Hall only let us vote for 10. There has been a movement among the writers to try to get us, to try to get the Hall to allow us to just say simply yes or no, not limited to 10. The ballot, the crowding has eased in recent years. It's not what it was, but there were guys who fell victim to that. Another player that I felt got short shrift was Lou Whitaker. Alan Trammell's in the Hall of Fame. Lou Whitaker was his double play combination guy and certainly a great, great player. So we can go on and on. And you're right. I don't like playing God, but you do have the ballot and you're asked to vote. So that's the job. And in a sense, you can make the case as a fan, a former player, current player, you guys are playing God. You can say that because ultimately that's the right evaluation of it. But that's not how I see it at all. And I'm just trying to make the best decisions possible. And I will say this too, Brett, generally speaking, not always, we get it right. We don't get it all right. And there have been some misses over the years. There are some guys who are in who shouldn't necessarily be in. And I'll give you an example there. I'll remember this forever. When Kirby Puckett got elected, a friend of mine, a guy named Joe Strauss, who's passed since, he worked for the St. Louis paper, said, "We just made a big mistake." And I said, "What are you talking about? Kirby Puckett, 2-time World Series champion. He did some amazing things. Great player, great personality. He's kind of what the Hall of Fame is." And he said, "No. Career was too short, through no fault of his own, and you can look at other players now, and Mattingly is the one who had similar type careers. And now, what are you going to do with them?" Now, I don't know that Kirby Puckett was a mistake, but it was a good point that Joe made. Hey, if Puckett's in, Mattingly probably should be in, and of course, Mattingly is not in.
And then you want to talk about Mattingly, we got to talk about Albert Bell, who to me, in my generation, wow, in the 90s, I don't know, you know, with the exception of Barry Bonds, who I hold in a different, he's just a different animal to me, and anybody I've ever seen on a field. I'll tell you what, Albert Bell in those 90s, that's a bad man right there.
Yes, it was. Yes, he was.
Great, and, you know, he had the health problems and he had to retire early. But, yeah, it's a great debate for, yeah, but what if him and what if him? No, those are all great points. Do you have any first ballot criteria for somebody to get on the first, or is every year just I'm voting for who I'm voting for?
Every year I wipe the slate clean and I'm voting for who I'm voting for. And I don't believe in this guy's not a first ballot Hall of Famer. You're either a Hall of Famer or you're not. And most of the first ballot decisions are relatively easy. Ichiro this year, easy. Yeah. I don't have to worry about that one. So I don't have a problem with it. And if I determine CC Sabathia is a Hall of Famer this year, I will vote for CC Sabathia. It's as simple as that.
As far as unanimous, I think there's only been one, Mariano.
Yes.
And as I was getting ready to talk to you today, I thought, how did Willie Mays not go unanimous? How did Hank Aaron, how is he not unanimous? How is Ted Williams not unanimous? Just to name a few of the icons. Why is that, you think, that Mariano's the only one to date?
Well, I can't speak for my elders, the guys who were voting for Mays and Aaron, and maybe there were a few women then, though I don't think so. There were people who were finicky back then. There were people who are finicky now, and they want to be a conscientious objector, for lack of a better term. They want to be a contrarian. And again, I don't believe in it. It's silly to me. Derek Jeter, what more do you want? Cal Ripken, what more do you want? These guys should be unanimous Hall of Famers. At the same time, I always say this too, Brett. You think Jeter cares that he wasn't unanimous? You think Cal Ripken cares that he wasn't unanimous? These guys are first ballot Hall of Famers. They've had great careers. They've done tremendous on and off the field. They don't have a problem. They're good.
Right, but in a Cal Ripken type situation, I want to ask the gentleman that didn't vote for him and say, give me your case against. Yes. And I'd like to hear that. Or is the case against, I don't want anybody to be unanimous. I don't know.
And that's probably the case against.
That seems silly to me.
What basis is Ripken not a Hall of Famer? What basis is Jeter not a Hall of Famer? It's a silly argument. You'd have to really come up with some interesting ideas to justify that kind of vote on a baseball level.
And I'm wearing you out about the Hall of Fame, but this is fascinating, and I don't get to talk like this with somebody that actually has a vote very often, so I'm going to hit you with a couple more. NFL, they have a different process than Major League Baseball. Someone's nominated, you speak on their behalf, it's a debate. Would that work in Major League Baseball, or is the current process the best that you think it can be?
I like our process. Actually, I don't like their process. It's secret. You never know what's going on. You never know who's voting for who and who's supporting who. And some things happen behind closed doors that are rather ugly. And I would hear about them back in the days when I was a columnist in Baltimore. And there were certain people I would hear, writers, who would lobby against players. And that's not our process. You either vote for the guy or you don't. And it's more transparent. Not everyone reveals their ballots, but most writers do. And it just seems to me the more open, the better. And the NFL is the opposite of open.
Long game for the Bonds, Clemens of the world who are now off the ballot. What do you see the long game being there?
It's going to be tough. And it's going to be tough because, generally speaking, the various iterations of the veterans committees have been tougher on these guys than even we have been. And it's former players, it's people who have been in the game, managers, executives, and they, for whatever reason, have been less tolerant of those players who had that kind of profile with the performance-enhancing drugs link. Is it possible in time they get in? Of course it's possible. And you can make the argument either way. In my view, even with A-Rod and Manny, you can make this argument. Let them in and put it on their plaque what they did. And that acknowledges the history. It acknowledges they were a great player, but it also acknowledges the history. Now, I'm not there yet with A-Rod and Manny, and maybe I never will be, but there is an argument to be made along those lines, but I don't know that the people voting on the Veterans Committee see it that way.
Pete Rose. I recently had him on the show before he passed away. And I've known Pete since, you know, I've been probably 9 or 10 years old. I spent a lot of time with him. I have more of a relationship with him as a 10-year-old than I did as an adult in passing, you know, through our travels when I was playing. I'd see Pete time to time, but I, you know, my childhood with Pete, I knew him very well. And every time I talked to Pete, he was always the same. He was that upbeat, you know, I loved his personality. He was one of my favorite guys of all time. And usually when you're a kid and you tag along with Pete Rose, you have fond memories of that. This last time I talked to him, and it was about 8 months ago, 10 months ago, he was different. And he was still Pete for the most part. But when we got to this Hall of Fame and talking, he got a little somber. I've never seen Pete Rose be somber in my life. And he just said, "Booney, you know, it was a big thing for me originally, and then I lied about it, and then I come clean." And he said, "Now I'm getting older." And he said, "You know," he said, "I don't know if I'm ever going to get in, you know, probably not." He said, "And for me," and it was weird listening to him talk like this, because like I said, I've never heard him talk in this vein. He was just different. And he said, "I wanted to get in the Hall of Fame for my friends and my family could celebrate with me, and it would be something special." He said, "And if they put me in after I pass away," he said, "who cares?" He said, "Who cares? Is it really worth it even having?" But it was really weird for me to see a somber Pete Rose. Now that he has passed, what's your take on Pete? Is it time, or is this the continuing going to play out the way it has for years and years?
Well, I would build off of what Pete told you. It's about family and friends. And even though he has passed, honoring him would be a way for his family and friends to celebrate his career in a way that they have not been given the opportunity. Now, a lot of that is Pete's own fault, of course. And Pete knows that. He knew that when he was alive. But at the same time, here's a situation where if he is reinstated by baseball, he too will go before a veterans committee. It's not going to go to the writers. That's the way it will work. For those people, the former players who knew the rule, right, Brett, it's in every clubhouse. It's posted on the wall. It's the cardinal rule of baseball.
It's the number one rule.
It's number one.
Yeah.
Everybody who knew that rule, who is voting on a veterans committee, is not necessarily going to be inclined to vote for Pete. Some will, of course. And I would imagine his former teammates, if Johnny Bench is on that committee or Tony Perez, somebody along those lines, yes. But it would be an uphill fight even if he was reinstated, and it will be an uphill fight for him simply to be reinstated.
Last one on the Hall of Fame, and I'll drop it, but it's really interesting to me now going into 2024, going into 2025. When I was playing the game, when my father was playing the game, we were actually paid or judged upon certain statistics for an offensive player. For instance, for me, it was average, home runs, RBIs. Now, the guys that had the speed, you would also throw in as a caveat, stolen bases had something to do with whether you were voted in or not. Defense, with the exception of a few guys, maybe an Ozzie Smith, it really hasn't played a part in the Hall of Fame so far. Nowadays, the players, it's an OPS era. It's different. We never said the word, and you remember, Kenny, we never talked OPS when I was playing, even in the early 2000s. It didn't exist. It's how many did I drive in, because that's what gets me paid, and that's where the long-term contract. Did I drive in 100? Did I hit 25, 30 home runs? What was my average? Those were all important things, and that's, as players, that's how we trained, because we knew what was important. Today, they train differently. The strikeouts are up, and I'm not. I hate when people say this. Nobody cares. Of course they care. But it's not a criteria. Criteria is getting on base and hitting the ball over the wall. And that's how players are trained. Do you think going forward in maybe the generation where you and myself are gone, it's going to change. Like you mentioned early, with when wins counted as wins for pitchers, that's much different now, because 300 was the gold standard. We train pitchers now to go five innings. So the wins and losses aren't as important, just like the average has become less important. I, for my generation, man, if you played 10 plus years and you had a 300 career average, that's mind boggling to me. Cause it's like, do you realize how hard that is, especially as a right-handed hitter? But today there's not as much importance put. Do you think going forward, some of the best hitters in the world, Mookie Betts, they're leadoff hitters. Shohei Ohtani's leading off. Obviously, your RBI total is going to go down. So those aren't, you know, becoming a different metric. So do you think in the future, our way of doing it, the RBIs, the home runs, the average, is going to change, and you're going to be voted on, okay, what were you judged on in the era you played in?
Well, you can only be judged on what was valued in the era you played in. And I always think this, that if Willie Mays knew what 40-40 was, he could have done 40-40 in his sleep. Right. But that wasn't valued back then. It wasn't a thing. Now, we know more today because of the rise of sabermetrics, the increase in information that we've gotten. And we have better context with our statistics. For instance, batting average is meaningful. We all know that. It demonstrates a hitter's skill. But on-base percentage and slugging percentage perhaps gives you a better insight into the hitter's skill, gives you an insight into his plate discipline and his power. So the whole package certainly is something to consider. And even with wins, it's the same thing. Wins are kind of dependent on your team, dependent on the bullpen, dependent on the offense. It's not necessarily reflective as well of a pitcher's individual performance as some of the other metrics we have. And that's where batting average has fallen short too, because some of the other metrics give us more. Now, that said, what you're talking about, Brett, is the way the game is played. And the way the game is played, in my opinion, is not necessarily a winning way at all times. Driving in runs, and this is the one where I have a problem with what has gone on in recent years. Driving in runs, the sabermetrics people will say, part of that's luck. It's not really a skill. No. You know this. I know this. There are guys who get up to the plate in those situations and have a knack for getting the job done, period. That should be valued. Putting the ball in play. Now, that's not valued by OPS, by on base, by slug. It's not valued. But we have seen in various ways how putting the ball in play can be meaningful to a team in its effort to win. So I always say with these kinds of things, I'd like to see more balance. We're not going back to the days of batting average and wins, but we can go back to a day where things are valued in a different way. For instance, putting the ball in play. And for instance, as well, pitching more than five innings as a starter. That's something that the game has now recognized as a problem. Manfred has talked about this. We need to bring back the starting pitcher. Hello. Yes, we do need to do that. Now, whether it's through rules, and that's probably what it's going to take, or different training, which is what will follow if the rules are enacted, I don't know. But at the same time, the game is better when you go to the park and you've got, I don't know, to use an example from your time, Randy Johnson versus Mike Mussina. Hello. That's what fans want to see. And we don't see enough of that now. And when we see it, the guys are out after five or six anyway.
Yeah, it's definitely different. And when the postseason was going this year, I talked about that a lot. I said, what happened to these marquee matchups? You know, the last you kind of remember is maybe like a Scherzer Verlander, but yep. Those guys are on the at the very end of their careers and they're kind of going away. The new way isn't that. And I still think the great, great ones, you still got to be able to go 7, 8 innings. You got to have the mindset, I'm going 9. That doesn't mean you go 9. But the thought process is I'm going 9. Now, the 3rd, 4th, 5th starters, just like any generation, if they can get 5 out of them and turn it over to the bullpen, I agree with that. But you're right. When it comes to the average, and this is what I tell people when they want to talk about average not being a big thing. I said, okay, it's a 9th inning. We got the closer in the game. What do great closers not do? They don't walk you. So your OPS, you're on base percent. You can throw that out the window in the 9th inning in a close game. Now, who do you want at the plate? Do you want somebody at the plate that's hitting 297 with a pretty good OPS, or do you want the guy hitting 217 that's got a great OPS? When the guy won't walk you and you're facing elite pitching and you're hitting 217, you've got no chance against an elite closer. So that's my argument for average, is average does matter because that means you're a better hitter. If you hit 220, and I don't care what era we're playing in, Kenny, you stink. You stink. I mean, I had some years where I hit 223 and I stunk. And I know it was a different time and a different generation, but I'm never going to wrap around my head around the concept that if you're hitting 226 with a decent OPS, you're doing a good job. I just can't wrap my head around it. Maybe that's the flaw I have.
No, I understand that. And certainly to players from your generation, some of the things that go on today, I'll speak for you, I think it's yeah. offensive. It's offensive to watch these guys because the strikeout is just, eh, whatever, that's fine. No, it's not fine. And it was never fine for you guys. Guys struck out, of course. Sure. But that was not like something that was looked at as, eh, no big deal. It was something that, eh, not great. So eras change, the game evolves. That's part of the beauty of the sport, right? That from era to era, it changes and it morphs and things happen that are different than before. But at the same time, some of the values from the past should not be lost. And that's really what we're talking about here, Brett. And some of the people running the teams today, the GMs, are younger and they're more statistically inclined and they have a different perspective. But there is some evidence that it's coming around back the other way. And you can look at the hiring of Buster Posey in San Francisco as perhaps one example of that. We'll see how it goes on because owners love the numbers. They love the presentations by the executives that say, well, if we do this, this, and this, it's going to happen right. Like this, this, and this. They love that. And understood, it is a projection system that they're looking at, and it's a way to judge what they have. But there is more to this game than science. There is an art to this game. There is nuance in this game. And that is what has gotten lost in recent years. And that's what needs to come back. And you'll talk to some of the statistically inclined people, the sabermetrics people, and they'll say, oh, no, we're good. We're not good. We're certainly not good from an entertainment standpoint. The entertainment product needed to be fixed because of what had gone on with the shifting and everything else and the slow pace of play. They had to implement rules to make the game more aesthetically pleasing again. I expect that they're going to need to implement rules to bring back the starting pitcher. And as we go along, do some other things as well, because as efficiently as the game is played, and yes, I understand why teams are striving for maximum efficiency. There's a lot of money at stake. It's not the entertaining product that it once was. And that is what the sport is trying to get back to and has under the new rules in recent years.
You know, I think you make a point about the owners, and these guys are brilliant businessmen and own successful businesses. You don't become an owner and a billionaire because you're not smart. But you're right. You cannot run baseball like you run Target. The X's and O's don't always, there's more to take into consideration. I still get into this with Aaron on occasion because my brother and me, we're very like-minded when it comes to the X's and O's of baseball. We have our differences and we love to debate them. Of course, Kenny, I'm usually right because I still am the older brother. But we talk about it and I just, there's certain things in the game. I said, Aaron, you can't just do this because this is what the computer told you to do. You've got to look inside. You live with these people for 162 games. You know them inside and out. You know a look, a glance, a wink, what that means. And that might mean I'm taking the ball from you right now, bring in the reliever. And that other look might mean he's got this. And you can't get away from that. You can't get away from managing with your gut because that's what the great ones do. Yeah, follow the protocol. Of course, today they have a different, you know, some of the decisions are made pregame on how this script is going to go. But in nut crunching time, I think the great ones still have a great gut and make that decision when it's necessarily that computer doesn't say make that decision, because anybody can make that computer decision and sit afterwards. And Kenny, you asked me a question and I say, hey, Kenny, that's what the computer said. He's right. That's what the computer said. I want to see people be great.
I will say this, not just about Aaron, but about every current manager. They have a tough job. They're trying to navigate just what you said. The front office saying this and the analytics people saying this and the human element that they witness and they see every day. And Aaron Boone managing the New York Yankees has it even tougher because of the spotlight that is constantly on him. Now, he has gotten criticism because he has been too much behind the players, at least in his public comments, right? He doesn't criticize players. That's his style. And it serves him well in that room. And again, to talk about different eras, Brett, when you were playing, and even before that, when your dad was playing, the manager could be a complete hard ass and could rip players, could confront them in the clubhouse. Lou Piniella fought guys in the clubhouse. That doesn't work anymore. So as much as fans might want red meat, it's not happening. And if it happened, he'd lose the clubhouse immediately. So Aaron, among other managers, has this incredible tightrope to walk. And I'm not defending him or anything like that, though he got to the World Series. He doesn't need any defense this year. But people need to understand that there is a lot going on with these guys. There is media responsibility. There is a responsibility to be the spokesman of the team before and after games every single day. There is a responsibility to your players, to your front office, to your fans. It's a lot. And actually, I think Aaron's done pretty well with this. It ages guys. Aaron looks okay, but other guys you see age pretty quickly in that job.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I mean, I think my brother's done a wonderful job. I'm not going to sit here and I try to shoot as straight as I can, and I stay in the middle and I take my brother hat off. And when I think I have a criticism or I disagree with him, I'll let you know. But in the end, with being in that spotlight in New York, I think he's done a hell of a job. And I tell him all the time, I said, listen, you're not going to please everybody all the time. You know, you mentioned a Lou Piniella. I think that the closest we've got right now probably is a Bruce Bochy, who's old school. Now he's new school. And I think that's a part of the process, though, of managing with your gut is Bruce knows he's not walking into the San Diego Padres clubhouse in 1998. The guys are different. Players are different. But I think Bruce is astute enough and smart enough. He's going in, first of all, he's Bruce. Everybody loves him. I've never met a man that doesn't love Bruce Bochy. So he's got that instant credibility. He's got the titles. He's got the World Series. But he's also smart enough to not treat the clubhouse, like I said, like that 98 clubhouse. The players are different. That's a part of playing the game. That's a part of knowing who you're dealing with and managing accordingly. When Aaron gets critiqued for backing his players up, I'll tell you what, I'm going to back my players up publicly. Nobody might know what goes on behind closed doors, but publicly, I know if I need to win tomorrow and I know what makes that gentleman tick. And I know if I critique him on the big stage, he's not going to play for me.
Right.
I've got to decide how I'm going to go forward with that. And people don't take that in consideration. You don't come certain guys. I'll give you an example of this. Davey Johnson, he was unbelievable at it. He would critique me and I would be like, how dare you? I was a young player in Cincinnati and I didn't get it. He would push my buttons, Kenny. I would get so mad at him and I would play a lot better because in my mind I said, I'm going to show you. I'm going to spite you. Years later, I talked to him. He goes, Booney, what do you think? I didn't know what I was doing. He said, I knew I could treat you that way. He goes, that would piss you off, but I was going to get a better player out of it. He said, if I treated player X that way, I knew he would quit. I had to kiss up and lovey-dovey with him. But with you, I knew if I could throw something that got under your craw, said I got a better player out of it. And years later, I thought, wow, that's genius. Now, the trick is knowing the players that you have to treat one way and right. knowing the players that you have to treat another. But that's just, you know, that's being the CEO of a company. That's getting the best out of all your players in the capacity that you get the best out of them. And I think that's what the great ones do.
Yes, and with Bochy, I wrote a story last year, a long story, about how he was adapting to this era. And the Rangers have a statistical analyst named Bobby Bandolo, young guy. He's probably in his early 30s. And he was the conduit between the front office and Bochy. I think he traveled with the team. And he definitely traveled with the team, and he was with them every day. And Bochy got along with him. He took it all in. He would question at times, of course, what he was seeing sure. and what he was hearing from Bobby. But they built a relationship. So Bochy adapted to this era. And that's one of the amazing things about him. He's got so many amazing things about him. But he adapted, yes, to the age of analytics. And he also adapted, as you said, to an era in which, let's face it, you just cannot be as confrontational with players as managers sure. once were. It just doesn't work the way it once did.
It doesn't work. And I think the great ones find a way to not be confrontational, but get the job done at the same time.
And I would imagine, like a guy like Aaron, right? We hear what he says publicly. Right. Behind closed doors, I would think that on occasion he's lighting a guy up. I can't imagine he's not doing that. He's the manager of the team. It's his ass. He's got a lot of responsibility. But again, he's not showing that to the public. And it might frustrate the public, but again, it keeps him in a good place with his players. And to me, as a manager, that's the most important thing.
By far.
You got to keep the guys playing. You got to keep them going. Now, I had quibbles with the Yankees this year and the way they ran the bases, the way they played defense, and whether it was a reflection on Aaron or the way the team was constructed, whatever. But they never came apart. Even when things were not going as well, they never came apart. They always were a pretty tight team, actually a remarkably tight team. So that is a testament to Aaron and what he has built there, the culture. It's just such a slippery slope. It's so difficult to do. And listen, I'm critical of managers. We all are, whatever. But the context of that is the job is really tough.
It's really hard. And even players of my generation or past generations, when they just come out with the blanket, our game was way better in these analytics. I just think, well, instead of just playing that card, tell me what you would do to make it better. And I think you'd be crazy in this day and age with technology and everything getting so much better and having access to so much information. You'd be crazy not to go from an old That's school right. mindset to be completely open-minded. Give me everything. I want the best of the best. I'll decipher what I use and what I don't use. But to be closed off to that, no, how we did it was the best. I think you're being naive. I think you're being ignorant if you take that approach in today's game. This game will run you over, Kenny. I found that out. If you want to sit in your ways and get off my lawn, guy, this game will just run you over and leave you in the background. I love
this
game.
It goes back to what you were saying, Brett, about having the information. A manager is sitting there. He's got all the information. But there are times where he has to deviate from that information because of what he is seeing on the field. The great ones, as you said earlier, do that. And that is the art of managing, frankly, in this era. So for people who say, enough of the analytics, get rid of, no, we're not getting rid of the analytics. We're not going backwards in terms of what information we have. The information right. not only is great in helping us evaluate players as fans and media, but it has helped players. Obviously, guys are taking their data, TrackMan, whatever, and changing grips, doing all kinds of things to make themselves better. It's a great thing. But at the same time, there have been costs with that, of course. And it's just the way the game is today. It's not a bad way. It's not a better or worse way than it was in the past. It's just different.
But believe me, in a lot of ways, I am envious of what these kids have at their fingertips and access. Oh, as a player, give me that. I'd be the happiest man in the world if I could pull into a city and just give me my computer. I'm going to go up to my room for about 2.5 hours, and I've got everything I need on everything for this entire series. I'd be in heaven right there as a player, because I was very much into give me all the information, give me. Back then, we had to fight for it. It wasn't that easy as it is today.
That's right.
I'm envious in a lot of ways. Okay, free agents. Juan Soto, where's he going? I got a list of guys here on both sides. I want to talk about Sasaki, the Japanese phenom. He's 23 years old, I think. Obviously, at the top is of the position players is Soto. Top of the pitchers for me is probably a Burns. Your thoughts? What are you hearing? Where's Soto going likely? And Burns, and then we'll go through a few, and I'll let you out of here.
Well, first of all, I hate to guess, because that's all it is at this point, a guess. The consensus in the industry is that Soto is the Mets to lose. Steve Cohen has the most money as the owner of the Mets, and he can outbid everyone. Whether it happens that way, I don't know. Things happen in free agency. I say this all the time, that spin your head that you never expect. A-Rod to Texas. Albert Pujols to the Angels. I could go on and on. Zach Greinke to the Diamondbacks. I'm not saying it's going to happen here, but I'm not going to rule it out as someone who covers the sport. Burns, I'm not sure. The AL East teams, with the exception of the Rays, are all looking at the top starting pitchers. And depending how things shake out with Soto and the Yankees, they could be a Burns team, it could be a Freed team, a Blake Snell team, who knows? But the Blue Jays, the Orioles, the Red Sox are all in that market. And again, that's not to say that they're the only ones in, but I would expect those teams to be coming out with a top starting pitcher at some point. And Sasaki, he's a different situation than all of them because he is subject to the international signing bonus pool. So he cannot be paid more than, it will be about $7 million in a signing bonus. Every team can afford that. So he will be available to every team, and teams will try to convince him to come, and we'll see where that ends up. He's a young guy. He's extremely talented, and people are salivating over him. So that's going to be a really interesting one. The Dodgers are considered the favorite. We know that. But again, this is a more open process even than a Juan Soto free agency because every team has the financial wherewithal to sign Roky Sasaki.
Christian Walkers are out there and Alex Bregman. Interesting. He goes back to Houston. Not too many guys get to stay and play with the same team. And I think there's a lot more that goes into it. You know, Juan Soto for me, and he's 26 years old. I watched him down the stretch. I watched how he answered the questions media wise. It was brilliant. It was a course that he had an unbelievable way, and how he was playing on the field didn't hurt him. But the way he handled, he didn't alienate the Yankees. He didn't alienate the fans. Right. He didn't alienate his teammates. At the same time, he said, I'm available. Because you only get to, you earn that free agency.
That's right.
A lot of us only get to be a free agent once in our life.
Listen, he turned down $440 million in an extension a couple of years ago because
he
was pointing toward free agency. Everyone knew this. It's not a secret. And no one should begrudge him that, of course. This is his choice. As you say, it takes 6 years to become a free agent. It's a hard-earned right that players have, and once they get there, it's their choice to do whatever they want, to make a geographic preference, to make a financial preference, to do it all together. Whatever they decide, that's their call, and no one should begrudge them that.
It's going to be interesting, though. If the money is in the ballpark from the Yankees, and like you said, Cohen and the Mets, he's a wild card. You never know what he's going to pay. He's got the most money. But if the Yankees are in the ballpark with the Mets, man, as a player, with what Juan did this year in the pinstripes, going to the Bronx on the biggest stage, being a Yankee, they're still, I don't care what anybody says, the Yankees are the Yankees. And to play in that city, to prove that, obviously, he likes that ballpark. He likes that batter's box. He loves that city. To go elsewhere for me, with the success rate being the way it was for him this year, that would be hard. But he's playing it close to the vest, and he's doing a pretty good job at it. Tanner Scott, probably the elite closer out there, bullpen guy out there. Where do you see him going?
Anyone's guess. A number of teams need a guy like Tanner Scott. I can see the Phillies certainly being in the market. They lost Estevez. Jeff Hoffman is a free agent as well, but again, Brett, I'd be only guessing. I have no idea. And when I say that, I can ask 30 GMs today, call them all up. They're not going to necessarily tell me what they're thinking. That's not their job. They tell me what they want to tell me. And I try to find out information from others as well. But with free agency, it really is a guessing process. And listen, go to yesterday, Kikuchi. He signs with the Angels. Did anybody see that coming? No one saw that coming. No one had that predicted. And that's the way free agency generally works.
A year ago, it was a different free agency than we thought it was going to be. Once you got Ohtani signed to that huge deal, Yamamoto came over from Japan, signed the deal. Everybody else kind of, what they would say, it was a disappointing offseason for players. Do you see it going back to normal, or still a little bit of from the owner's perspective, some thoughts on the TV contracts? Everything's still up in the air. Do you see it going back to kind of how it was 2 years ago, or is there still a little bit of last year left over?
Good question. And I'm going to close with this. I do see the top players getting paid. They always do. And there are several top players in this market. You mentioned most of their names so far. The TV thing is real for several teams, realer for others than for some, but it will have an effect on some clubs. I expect that we're going to see what we usually see. The top guys get paid. The middle guys maybe struggle a little bit. Some of them will do well. Some of them will get squeezed. And then the lower tier free agents are perhaps going to have problems. That's just kind of the way the game works under the current system. And I don't expect it to be any different. The big mystery, the big question is what's going to happen with teams that have concerns about their future local TV revenue. Will they be confident that it's moving toward resolution and that they're going to be okay in the long run? Or are they going to use this as a way to say, we're not ready to spend just yet, with still some questions and a decline in revenue from where we were before?
And the Oakland A's, whole different ballpark, a whole different ballgame going to Sacramento. How are they going to get guys? It's going to be interesting on that, on that. Until that gets rectified, I don't know. Kenny, I appreciate you coming on. Always great to have you on. For those of you watching the Brett Boone podcast now, we have our own YouTube channel. Check it out. For those of you listen to the podcast on the Odyssey app, wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, keep it here. Thanks, Kenny.
Thank you, Brett.